The ongoing tariffs, I've been diving into that a little bit.
Would also lead to a squeeze and Bitcoin running up in price.
Companies are 25, 30, 40, 50 times earnings. Why are they being valued? Are they that master executors? When it's good, we'll party, right? You know, it's easy to talk when things are good, but it's been really fun to not have the price action while launching it, because it's given us other things to talk about and like build the foundation. We really don't have a real enemy,
yeah.
You know, for the first time in a very long time.
Yeah.
Government's on people's side.
Thank you for joining me today. I have Trey here. We've talked before on your podcast.
I'm excited.
I want to know kind of what you want to talk about today.
There's a lot of stuff going on with like the ongoing tariffs. I've been diving into that a little bit. You know, obviously I have a finance background. and so it's been interesting kind of like seeing the intersection of my work with the intersection of Bitcoin. They're kind of colliding a little bit now.
What is your finance background?
Yeah, so I work in the mortgage industry. I've been in the mortgage industry since like 2 weeks after COVID is when I got into it. So it's been about 5 years. And so we're constantly, not from like my position, I'm on more of like the front facing sales side of, you know, we have to understand how to structure loans and, you know, the risk involved in each loan, and that helps us price it and all kinds of good stuff like that. But, you know, our operations team and our like back end finance team, they're heavily looking at all this data that's coming out, because we're trying to project ahead of like how to run a company and be profitable, you know, with all of this stuff going on. You know, like how does this, if we can't get lumber from Canada and there's tariffs on it, how does that affect home building? How does that affect our clients that are building 30, 40 properties at a time, you know, and expecting their lumber cost to be X and it's really gonna be 25% higher, which is Y, you know what I mean? And so that's, you know, the other aspect of it is we do a lot of, you know, 30-year term, you know, 30-year loans for investors. And those are all tied to the treasury market, right? The bond market. So yeah, last week was kind of crazy because you had the bond market dipped to below 4% and then it shot right back up to 4.5. It was kind of behaving, you know, those percentages, it was kind of behaving like a shitcoin a little bit, you know, and that's not what you want out of your, you know, out of your bond market, out of your treasury market. So all of those things kind of factor into play. But really the biggest portion of it that comes into play for us is the, you know, how do we manage risk going forward? Because we're not a bank. We are a private debt fund. We have our own capital. We have to responsibly lend that capital out because we don't get bailouts from the US government. And that's why, you know, that's why our interest rates are a little bit higher, but it's also, you know, it's also why our underwriting process is a lot, you know, easier and more common sense than banks. There's just a lot of factors that you have to take into consideration, because again, if we go, you know, sideways, we just shut our doors. You know, daddy Jerome Powell can't come and save us, unfortunately.
Right. So how are you thinking about managing risk in this situation?
You know, I think for us, since we lend on, you know, since we lend on assets like homes, you know, if you look back over the last few years, I mean, COVID, they printed a ton of money, and the asset prices went crazy, right? Which is good for, it's good for investors that are selling properties to an extent. The tricky part with housing, though, is at some point, you know, housing prices go up too much, you're going to have issues finding buyers that can afford it, right? Home affordability is a huge problem. And so from one aspect, it seems good, you know, on paper, they're going to print money. All of our investors are going to make money on the deals. But at some point, that's going to become a double-edged sword because you're going to have people be priced out of the home affordability in markets. And it's going to be a little bit, you know, it's going to be a little bit tougher to find buyers. So, you know, from our perspective, there's always going to be people that want to, you know, own homes. I think the way that we manage risk is we're a little bit more selective about the, you know, properties that we take on, in the sense that, like, if you're going to do a luxury property, it's got to be in an area with super high demand. Because what ends up happening in the housing market is, like, you have, you know, say you're doing a $300,000, $400,000, $500,000 home. I would say anything between $300,000 and $1 million at this point. Mm-hmm. You're going to have a bigger buyer pool there than you're going to have for, you know, homes that are $1 million and up, right? And so when you have uncertainty in the market, you're really not going to see that market get, you know, hit too hard because there's just so many buyers there. What you're really going to see is on the luxury side, like maybe somebody who was going to buy $1.5 million home is now being a little bit more conservative because of the tariffs, because of all of this uncertainty. Look, maybe they had, you know, 5 million in the stock market and now they're freaking out, right? Because it's 4.5 million almost overnight. Mm-hmm. So now instead of buying a $1.5 million house, they're buying, you know, 1.2 or 1.1, and they kind of slowly trend towards that, you know, that other bracket. So that's kind of how it's a long way to say it, but that's how we manage risk on the construction side of things, is that you'll typically find those, you know, $300,000 to $1 million houses, depending on which kind of part of the country you're in, are going to be the least risky, you know, in an environment like this.
Yeah. So that 100% makes sense. How do you feel that what's going on with these tariffs? I feel like you shouldn't look at market short term, because this is just going to cause the Fed to lower interest rates and, you know, the government to refinance its debt. And that's kind of what we knew. That's what we knew would play out for a while now. You know, the interest rates have been high. They were raised abnormally higher and faster than they ever were before. And now this tariff situation is causing markets to dump, which will force the Fed's hand. And a lot of countries are now, you know, working with the U.S. as far as the tariffs, but with this whole China situation, how do you see that playing out?
Yeah, it's a great question. I've been looking at this a lot, and I think that X is a funny place, right? Because everybody, it's social media, right? So everybody's got this like short term, like I like to call it like microwave mentality, right? 30 seconds and then you're on to something new. I think that the way that they did it was great, in the sense of like, hey, we're not fucking around. We're going to get everybody's attention here. You know what I mean? And look, it caused a lot of chaos, but you're going to see, they're not going to be dumb about it. Right. So like, for instance, let's go back to the Canada example, and we can use China too. But if people are struggling to build homes, what are they going to do? They're going to go back to Canada and they're going to give an exemption on the things that we actually need. And I think that that's more of the purpose of the tariffs, is like, let's figure out what we actually need to import from these countries, and let's loosen tariff guidelines there. But let's also make sure that people aren't getting one over on us on stuff that we can produce here. You know what I mean? And honestly, like, let's squish these other countries a little bit and see who starts to squirm, right? I mean, again, I don't trust politicians, but apparently there's 60 plus, you know, countries already negotiating with us, right? And the reason is we have exported our debt, but we're also massive consumers. So these tariffs hurt these other countries just as much as they hurt us, right? And the U.S., because of the, you know, status they have, not only with the dollar, but because of how many people and how much we consume here, these other countries are going to get hit just as hard, if not harder. You know, which puts, like, it's not like a no leverage situation. I mean, if you're a small Latin American country, right, if you're in El Salvador, right, and you're trying to play hardball, but you barely, you know, like, if you, you know, if you put tariffs on somebody, they don't even notice that that they're, you know, that they're not selling to you anymore. It's a lot tougher to play hardball, but we have what, 350 million Americans. Like, we are big buyers of all this stuff. So it just makes sense to, like, look, even if say from all of the countries on average, we get taxed 30%, like aggregately on average. If we get that number down to 15%, because some countries are still at 30, but now some are at zero, like, that's a win for the country. And so I think that that's the model that they're going with. I do think part of it was to try and force the 10-year, rate down, because they have the debt to refinance. But it's a nuanced thing. I'm of the opinion, like, just let it play out. And I think you can really see on Twitter who's levered in the wrong places because they're freaking out. Like, S&P drops 7% or 4% or whatever it was, and people are, like, screaming for bailouts. Like, that's fucking crazy. Like, how levered are you guys to where 4% is causing you to, like, you know, not be able to lose sleep, you know, not be able to get sleep at night. So that's kind of my approach, you know, with it. I think we'll see strategic tariffs. I mean, we already saw in China that, like, there's certain things that we're keeping, you know, we're putting a pause on the tariffs for. Like, that's what we're going to see. And, like, we're going to see who actually has leverage over us versus who we have leverage over, which, again, I think is good, at least until you can make stuff here, right? Some of this stuff is going to take years to make, whether it's a factory or whatever it might be. So you're going to have to play a slower game there.
And I think when it comes to China and what's going on and how they're standing firm, you know, they're holding their ground. If you want to be able to produce more in the US, which is the goal, to have more entrepreneurs and, you know, companies bring back jobs to the US and build here, you need to have the tooling companies, you need to have the factories built, they would need to invest in these things to kind of start up that industry. Because right now there's people that I know, an entrepreneur who is just about to launch his company, and he was planning to go through China, but now he's rethinking the whole thing. Do I go through a different country that I can try to create my product instead of China, because who knows how long this will take, and you can't really do it here because it would cost like 3-4 times the amount of money to produce it, and there really isn't the tooling in America. So it's almost like we need this to come back to America, but it will take years for them to build this stuff unless they jumpstart the production of these companies to help people produce things here, you know. So I don't know how that's all. Yeah.
I was gonna say, it's just like the commitment of, like, hey, here's what we're doing, which has gotten companies fired up, in my opinion. You know what I mean? And I think that that's a powerful statement, and they're trying to back that up as much as possible. And these guys aren't, like, there's a tendency, look, a lot of politicians are stupid, I'll say that, but, like, these guys are not stupid. Like, they're not going to commit one political suicide by just tanking everything. And two, they're going to, you know, like I said, they're going to look at, they're just taking a sharper look at, like, what do we actually import and what is absolutely necessary. And, like, I think that's where you'll see the most lenient tariffs. And, you know, aside from that, I think things are going to go on largely unchanged. I mean, you're seeing all the exemptions that are given. So I think it's blown out of proportion.
And the exemptions is that, I think, from as far as last night, was the Apple iPhone manufacturing and, you know, computers and all that stuff. Did they actually give the exemption for that? Do you know?
I don't know if they actually finalized it. I know that's what was circulating. But look, I wouldn't be surprised if they did. I mean, they're not. It's not. Again, there's the political element here. They're not going to have iPhones go to $10,000 a phone.
And that's why, even though it's not a bailout when it comes to, like, Apple saying, hey, if you guys, keep these tariffs, as far as if you don't exempt Apple, then the iPhone price will keep skyrocketing. Everything that Apple makes would go up in price. But in a roundabout way, I feel that by doing the exemption, if that's what they actually did do, it almost seems like we're trying to play hardball with China so they can, bend the knee and work with us. But when you do give these exemptions for some stuff, it's like, it's because a company like Apple is one of the Magnificent Seven, and they're feeling like not only will their prices of their products go super high, and then if they're not selling, they have risk to go bankrupt. So it's almost like a roundabout way of a bailout, you know, because it's like, yeah, hey, fine, we will allow this because we know that if you go down, everyone that's invested in Apple will have issues, and it could be like a systematic infection of crisis, you know, spreading through the system. So I think that they are sort of making this exemption because they know that it could be a big issue since so many people are invested in big companies like that.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, look, the Mag 7 is all tech, right? When you think about it. And the Mag 7 is also responsible for 93%, I think, of the gains in the S&P 500. Yeah, I mean, like, if you're going to talk about centralization versus decentralization, you look at the rest of the S&P and they're, you know, the gains are almost flat. Almost everything comes from the Mag 7. So yeah, those guys are going to have, you know, they're going to have say, again, because of the political ramifications. Like, there's a lot of people that have money, whether it's 401k or whether they're, you know, in the stock market. The way that I kind of see this playing out, and this is just like a theory that I kind of thought about this morning when I was, you know, going over all this stuff, is like, when you think of Trump's voter base, it's like 50% Midwesterners who just want factory jobs and just want things done in America, right? And then you have like 50% of the people that are being affected right now, like today, because of like the stock market stuff, right? They're all heavily invested in stocks. And, you know, right now it seems like catering to the 50% that are the Midwestern, right? Like the middle-class Americans. And I think the only way, I think their strategy behind this. So I'll try to put this as concisely as I can. So follow with me here a little bit. But how are you going to show 50%, like that 50% middle America, how are you going to show them that you're going to bring jobs back, right? It has to actually start to be done. So like, yeah, they can't make these factories overnight, right? But if he shows this voter base that they're committed to it, they're going to see the factories going up in their town. They're going to see the millions and hundreds of millions, I think it might even be billions, of investment that is getting funneled to the US. So like that, in my mind, they're trying to check that box first, because you're like everybody on Twitter, you as well, you're absolutely right in the sense that it's going to take a long time to actually, you know, build this stuff. But just like the starting of building it and the money that's announced that's flowing in so that we can reshore, like that's going to make that voter base feel heard for the first time in 50 years, right? So even if they're not necessarily reaping the benefits, it would make sense logically that if they see something going in the right direction, they're going to continue to vote for the people that are going to do that, right? That are going to finish up those projects.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the reason I think he's doing this now is because he can't do this and also have the stock market, you know, pumped at the same time. So it's like, now go win that voter base, go show them that progress is being made here and that things are coming here. And then what are they going to do? They're going to pivot, and we're going to see all-time highs in stocks and all this stuff through this kind of like exemption process and, you know, tariff. Like the thing about, we talked about the Mag 7, the thing about the Mag 7 and the S&P 500 is like, yeah, it's all centralized, but if you want to fix the problem of what the S&P is going through, just fix the problems of those seven companies, and then you'll see all-time highs. So that's kind of how I think they're trying to play it out, is like, let's appeal to these middle class Americans that haven't had anybody appeal to them and actually do anything in 50 years, and actually show them that we're going to do something by starting to get production going here, even if it takes 5 to 10 years to actually get it up and running. And then it's a lot easier to go back and pivot before midterms to the other 50% of his voter base that own the stocks and, you know, investment properties and things like that. That's kind of how I see that playing out.
I think that I see that being the way it's going to go too. The other thing I wonder is the longer this trade war continues between the US and China, it almost feels like if it lasts a long time, the US would have to print money, almost bailout, almost even if it's an indirect bailout by allowing exemptions, let's say, so that things don't collapse or cause really big problems. I feel like China is going to be inflating their currency to fight this whole, you know, because again, they're losing a lot of consumers from the US, you know, they're not being able to generate all that revenue. And I don't think their markets were doing great. I'm not 100% sure, but I think China, they already had a housing market crisis and all these things. So if this trade war continues for a long time, it's going to cause pain for our country and theirs, but it's just who's the stronger one who can hold out longer. But I feel that all leads to, you know, more inflation between two major countries in the world that would also lead to a squeeze and Bitcoin running up in price, you know, because now you're just like these two countries that are stubborn are trying to fight it out who's going to be the winner. And I think in the meantime, they're going to have to support their economies by printing money in order to hold out longer. So I really wonder how long this will last. And I feel that this would lead to, you know, Bitcoin just continuing to increase because of the more fiat is floating around the world. You know, that's yep. What happens.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think it's multifaceted. I mean, their economy is way worse off than ours. If you look at their, you know, stock market and things like that, it's been flat. It's almost been negative, you know, the last decade or so. And so the thing to think about, in this case is when these countries, like, you know, say China, for instance, like, and this has ramifications throughout our stock market too. But when these countries are profiting off of us, right, they're in a surplus, where do you think their money goes? It goes to the US stock market. When we start to see, you know, them not making as much money off of us, like, that's going to have ramifications through the stock market. And Jack Mahler's was talking about this, you know, a week or two ago, is like, that's going to cause issues with the prices of all the stuff. Like Nvidia, the stock price is like 50 times their earnings right now. Like, that's crazy.
I remember hearing about that a long time ago, how not just it's the Magnificent Seven that's pretty much holding up, you said 93% of the stock market, but I heard about Nvidia too being where they have, if they start to go down, it could like tank the stock market because it's so huge. And I know people that are heavily invested in it, and I feel bad for them because I don't know. They keep saying like, what do you think is going to happen? I'm like, well, I'm pretty sure it's going to just, you know, things will turn around, you know, because I think more things will be manufactured in the US, and there's always positive news coming about the coming out about the company. But they are such a giant company, like a whale of a company. I don't know how much their market cap compares to Apple or Amazon or anything, or Google, but I think they're massive. And I hope that it doesn't just hurt him in general, but I know a lot of people are very much invested in it. So it's like, I don't know what's going to happen with that.
Well, you start to have that realistic conversation of like, what am I actually investing in here? Because it's not just Nvidia. I mean, it's like all of those companies are 25, 30, 40, 50 times earnings. Why are they being valued? Are they that master executors that like, why are they being valued so much? Right. And you start to have that conversation. And it's just because a lot of these, like a lot of foreign capital is flowing into our stock market because it's been like the state safe haven. But now we're telling all these countries like, hey, get your money and get the fuck out. You know what I mean? And so it's like, what are these? That's the other part of it that relates to Bitcoin, is like, now if you have these, you're telling other countries to kind of get the hell out of our markets. One, where's the liquidity in the stock market going to come from? Two, where are they going to put their money? Right. Like if you're the Chinese government, are you putting it into your own stock market or are you putting it into a neutral reserve asset?
Right. I know that's a huge, great point because yeah, if they're going to be pulling out of our stock, well, what do you put it in your stock market that's been flat for however long, 10 years,
yeah.
I think you said. So it's something that you want to put it in something that's going to appreciate. And Bitcoin is, I feel the way that people are going to start moving towards that decentralization. Cause I heard somebody mention too, that this trade war with China, and they say that this will just cause like China wants to be the world reserve currency, but that doesn't seem possible in this new world that we're living in because people don't trust, just like how the Byzantine generals problem was solved with Bitcoin. It's that whole idea that nobody trusts the other person and we can't agree on anything. So if you make China the world reserve currency, like people are already losing trust in the dollar, then you're going to ask everyone to trust China. That's not going to happen. So that's why Bitcoin would win because it solves that problem. You don't have to worry about trusting each other. No one can be locked out of it like they did to Russia. So it just seems like the end game, you know, is that where it won't be China winning over the US. It won't be, you know, I don't think the US dollar will continue to have that role in the future. And I think most Bitcoiners believe that. You do need something decentralized. But yeah, whatever your thoughts are on that.
Yeah, it might be like I could see the US dollar being like the global reserve currency, right? Like settlement layer, but it's not going to be what people hold their excess capital in, right? Like I think that the fiat, you know, currency in general, like that world order and that thought process has just been debunked left and right. And like all of every developed country in the world is panicking right now because they've seen it play out for the US, right? Like we've hollowed out our infrastructure for 50 years. Now we make nothing here and all we export is debt and the quality of life has gotten worse. Like every other country has seen this experiment play out. So like who's going to volunteer, right? Like who's going to say, "Oh, we'll do that." And like for China, like I've never really gotten why they would want to do it because they have all the manufacturing there. Like typically what you're trying to do when you're a reserve currency is export debt. So you want to get rid of all that. So like that, even I'm not saying that they didn't want to do it, but like that never really made sense for me. Like logistically speaking, why would they kind of give all that up? I think if you look right now, we have it very bad as far as like a sovereign debt crisis, but like China's economy is way worse. Japan's economy is way worse. Like the European Union is falling apart. They're talking about one CBDCs, but they're also talking about, you know, starting a sovereign wealth fund, essentially with their citizens' savings, which is just so, so fucked up. So like all of the reason all of this is happening, I mean, Germany sticks out too, because they have massive energy problems because they've shut down nuclear plants there to, you know, in favor of this green initiative bullshit. So like, there are so many issues debt-wise that like all of this stuff is going to sort of unwind. And I think it's, look, you said like, where do we go? I do think it's gold or Bitcoin, but the issue then becomes like, nobody trusts each other anymore. So like, are you really going to trust that, you know, China's gold is backed one-to-one with everything that they give out? Like say they make a new currency, right? A new gold-backed currency. Who's going to trust that the new yuan is backed one-to-one with gold?
And how will we know when China doesn't even let us know anything that's going on over there already as it is? How would we even know that they have the gold that they say they have? And then when it comes to our gold reserves, like in Fort Knox, we haven't still, we heard that they were going to audit that, but we still don't know if it's there or how much is there or has it been melted down and covered over other pieces? Like, will someone verify that? How do we know how much gold there is? So yeah, when people are owning gold on the stock market, I keep hearing, like, I even heard someone mention to me yesterday, I tried having this debate with a friend who understands Bitcoin. You know, we've talked about it many times. They understand it, you know, but for some reason it's not clicking in his mind. Like he still thinks that gold is what people would run to. And I'm telling him, if there was no Bitcoin, okay, fine. You'd have, what are you going to buy a bunch of gold and have it sitting in your home? And what if someone breaks in and steals it, or, you know, something happens to it? Or would you buy stock in gold? And how do you know, like, they could just keep adding more paper version of that? You don't know how much gold there actually is. What are you actually buying? What are you actually owning? And if you wanted to travel with the gold, I tried to tell them these things. I'm like, you can't just take your gold and run and carry bags of gold with you wherever you want to go. And if you leave the country too, and you want to just leave America for whatever reason in the future, you can't just say, I'm taking my American stock market gold with me. You have to sell that. So I just think people still, it's so weird to me that even though he says he understands Bitcoin, I think it's because, people just still don't understand that much about it. You know, they must say, like, I get it, but they don't really get it, if they're saying that. It's definitely the only option, I think, in our opinion, is why would you get gold when you can get Bitcoin? You know, so yep. That's just the way we see things playing out.
Yeah, agreed. I mean, look, like, it's also gotten a lot more real for a lot more people, because like 4 or 5 years ago when we talked about this stuff, we were like, hey, they can actually like freeze your funds, and like the bank and, you know, the money in the bank's not actually yours. The gold that you own is not actually yours. I mean, like, we've seen examples of this over and over again, right? Like a few months ago, there was like a run on gold in the Bank of England, right? And they were struggling to get, people were actually trying to withdraw their gold, and they were struggling to find all the gold for it. Why? Because they papered over it, right? Mm-hmm. It's already happened. Like, that's, I also think that the price of gold is probably being suppressed right now. Like, it's just, whenever they have the option to paper over it, they're going to do that because they hold the actual asset, right? They hold the gold. So why not just paper over it if people are never going to take it? And now we've seen the Canadian truckers be debanked. We saw the whole crypto industry be debanked. Like, all of this stuff was just theory 5-6 years ago for most of the developed, at least for the developed world, right? Third world countries, they've seen all of it. Right. And us in our little bubble, we were like, oh, that'll never happen to us. It'll never happen. You know, it'll never happen here. Right. And then we saw it. Right. We saw it actually happen here.
If people think that China's yuan would become the world reserve currency, with everyone seeing what happened, not only with all that stuff, but with Russia, how Russia was sanctioned and taken off the SWIFT system, then it's like, OK, we're having a problem with the USA. Russia is now not allowed. So why would we have a currency? I don't know why people think, you know, China would win as far as that status, because they could just take us out of that system, you know? Yeah. So if we just decide, yes, okay, China's the new world reserve currency, that argument doesn't work, you know, because then we're going to allow ourselves to be kicked out like Russia was from us. So and they're also a Russian ally too, aren't they? So they wouldn't play nice with us in that way. So it's just, it's very chaotic, but it's also just fun to talk about it with somebody who gets it, you know, somebody who knows, about Bitcoin and who believes why Bitcoin is important. But it makes you feel that when you understand Bitcoin, this is all just kind of like funny. Like,
it's a game. You're absolutely right. It's like when you have a 35,000 foot view, you can see all of this, you see all the pieces on the board playing out in real time. Meanwhile, most people are on the board just, you know, freaking out as the moves play out, but they just don't have the higher view of everything. And look, like, it's not to say that anything that I've said earlier is going to 100% play out, but it's just like, you can see the moves with more clarity when you take that bigger view of everything. And honestly, like, you just look, I think Bitcoiners do this sometimes too, where we just are so, you know, we like to think we have a long time horizon on everything. But you start to see it, you know, one thing's announced and people are freaking the hell out about it. And it's like, you have to give these things time to materialize.
I wonder if the reason, like, if you look at Twitter and you see people just echo chambering the heck out of all these topics, it's almost because, part of it, we do, it is like the people that are posting about these things are, you know, it's engagement farming too. They're getting a lot of attention when something's trending. Second of all, we do also like to read up on a few things because it is interesting. It's kind of like just entertaining to us because we don't care. Like we're already outside of that system. We're already not, it doesn't really, you care more because you're in that space where this is your job right now.
Yep.
And you're worried about it because you're trying to figure out your moves as far as work goes. But as far as you, where you save your money, you're not just like, oh my God, my entire life is in this system and my work and everything. But when, I think people just start to just have this echo chamber for engagement and people just like to do it. But it is fun to watch it play out, but it's not like we care that much, you know, especially like I said, for your work situation, yes, you're going to care because you need to know what moves to make, you know, but at least it's not your whole life. At least you're saving in Bitcoin and you're not like thinking that all you have is your 401k and your job. And at least you have a little like an exit, you know, you're not stuck.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I think it's also given me, you know, kind of some unique perspectives on this other world, right? Because everybody in the traditional finance world, they're all listening to the Keynesian economics of, you know, here's what's going on and this and that. And it's really tough to pivot when you're listening to the wrong opinions over and over again, you know? So like the company I work for is relatively small. I've known, you know, two of the founders since they started it. And it's kind of cool to have their ear on some of this stuff of like, you know, here's what I'm seeing and all that good stuff. It helps us as a company. And not only does it help there, it helps with my clients, right? Like my clients are about to do multi-million dollar real estate deals. To have somebody that kind of can make sense of all of this chaos and lend an ear on it is usually pretty valuable. So it is very, very, very cool to see, like, you know, the Bitcoin thought of you on everything, and also like the, you know, TradFi kind of, you know, points of view on everything else.
Do you also try to, I know that you're pretty close with the founders because you were there since it started. Do they listen to you about Bitcoin, or do you ever try to talk to them about anything about that? Or do you just keep it super? Cause you don't want to get like cross a line, you know?
Yeah, no, look, I've told them for the last 6 months that we should put, you know, Bitcoin on our balance sheet. But it's one of those things where we are a growing company. So like MicroStrategy, it goes back to that whole thing. It's like MicroStrategy was a dying company. They were a zombie company. Sailor said it. And that's why they had to take a different approach. We've grown, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars year over year in our actual like loan volume that we do. So it's not desperate enough yet, right? And so like they're, you know, right now they're listening to me, and I've been saying for the last 6 months, you know, pretty much since 60K, that we should put Bitcoin in the balance sheet, and they've seen it run up to 109 and, you know, down to 75. And
well,
so
that's what I think is interesting about these price, you know, when Bitcoin's volatile, I think it's interesting because when you first tell somebody about it and they remember the price, oh man, when they first told me about it, it was 60,000. But it's almost like that little seed that's planted for people, because even though they're not thinking about it now because they think, oh, it went up to 100K, I should have bought it, because they start feeling FOMO. But then it drops down to 80K and they think, well, it could drop more, it could drop to 60 again. So they start thinking about it. It's almost like the seed is planted. But I feel that every time Bitcoin's price goes up, they play that mind game with themselves. Like, should I have gotten it? You know, they get FOMO. It drops. Then it almost like every time it drops, they start to think again, should I just get in now? And I think like at one point it'll click for them. And that's why people say like you get Bitcoin at the price you deserve, because you do play these mind games with yourself when you think, okay, I heard about this thing. Will it go up? What's a good time? But eventually you end up getting into it. But I think that at least that seed is planted where they remember you mentioning it, and they'll keep remembering every time they see the price go up or down.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I've been more vocal about it, obviously, recently with the, you know, the last run up that we had. I don't want to call it the bull market, because I don't think the bull market has started yet. But I could see them potentially doing something next cycle, right? Mm-hmm. Because I do think we're going to have a pretty sizable run up here. And maybe I'm wrong, but like all signs point to, you know, a couple $100,000 per Bitcoin this year. And I think that's going to be like their oh shit moment, you know, of like, oh, you were telling us to put, you know.
And I think.
Yeah.
I think the bigger money that people play with when you have people who start off with a little money, they're looking for a way out. They find Bitcoin. They find out what's great about it. But when you have companies with bigger and bigger amounts of cash reserves, it's almost like the higher the price goes, the more they're interested. Because it's like now it actually matters. Now I think it's not going anywhere. Now I think this thing must be important. Because when it reaches their radar, their level of what might be something that they should be looking at, or their market cap reaches a certain amount, like Bitcoin's market cap reaches a certain amount that's actually like they can't help but look at it. When they think it's too small for them, they just, yeah. So I just think that the larger the price gets, it attracts larger people because they actually start to care or look at it. Because it's almost like you think about rich people who have, you know, all these luxury cars and luxury homes and all this stuff. And they wouldn't look at a basic car to buy. They want to look at the luxury car because, oh, this is a nice new car. That's the shiny new thing that I want. Yep. But if it's just something that's kind of like, well, what is this thing? I don't care. But once it attracts their attention, then it's like, now it's worth it. You know, so it's almost like you'll buy it for a higher price. I don't know. That's just kind of.
I agree. I mean, look, and I think like risk profile matters for a lot of these big companies. And like, by no means are we a multi-billion dollar company or anything like that. Like I said, it's a 6-year-old company. It's a startup. You know, so like we don't have those sort of cash reserve balances. But I think for like the bigger companies, you know, when we're talking publicly traded companies, the risk profile is the number one thing they're looking at, which is like, hey, what are the chances this goes up versus going to zero? And I think for the first time ever, they've started to see that like, whoa, the chances that this goes up, not only a little bit, but a lot, are huge versus, you know, the chance that it goes to zero. Like risk adjusted right now in the 70 to 100K range, I think it's the best time ever to buy Bitcoin. Because it, like there's so much shit that people don't realize that happened over the last, you know, 16 years since it started. I mean, there's so many things that like there used to be like genuine concerns of like waking up in the morning and like the network not being there anymore. Mm-hmm. Right. And we're kind of past that now. Obviously, like there's always going to be stuff that comes up, but I think that that's why there's so much like infighting in the Bitcoin community right now is because we really don't have a real enemy.
Yeah.
You know, for the first time in a very long time.
Yeah.
Like it's like the government's on people's side and, you know, now you don't have the block size war anymore. Like all of those things were massive.
You're right. It's such a good thing that you bring that up because within the Bitcoin community, within the crypto community, like all these years, you did have the block size wars. You had people trying to create all these forks and different better versions of what's going to be the next Bitcoin and a lot of that stuff. And I think that there's been a lot of uncertainty about if Bitcoin will be the one, like, will there be, was Bitcoin, like people thought was Bitcoin the MySpace and now there's going to be a better, you know, but now it's come to a point where anybody who understands the cryptocurrency space knows that Bitcoin is it. And it's now again, adopted by governments and it's not going to, or you're right. It's the first time that you can say that this thing is actually at the beginning of its actual growth. Like even though it grew from nothing to hit $100,000 in 16 years, people think, wow, that's insane. But it's like, when you think about it from what you just said, that this is the first time nobody's actually trying to fight it or convince people that it's not going to be the one that's going to last, but now it's being embraced that way. Like it will be around. That is a pretty humongous turning point. So this little slow point that we're seeing right now is like the curve that actually causes that massive suddenly phase, you know, is what I see.
Well, you're also like, think about it in the perspective. If you have somebody that's got a $10 million or $100 million net worth, go back to what Saylor says. People are just looking for a way to preserve that wealth into the future. So like you're very unlikely to invest in something, even if you think it has a 1% chance of going to zero, if you have that much capital, right? You're much happier to do the S&P 500. You're much happier to do, you know, a 60-40 bond portfolio. And I think that's where you're going to start to see this capital come in is like somebody that's got $100 million allocation, you know, maybe now instead of writing off Bitcoin completely, they put $5 million in, right? And they're happy with the, that's the other thing. Like we, as, you know, plebs, a lot of times we're looking at like these like 100x or 50x returns that we see in the future. Not everybody is looking at it through that lens. Like we look at it through that lens because that's like life-changing wealth that can set up generations to come if you have enough of it, right? Most people that have money already, like the people that are coming to Bitcoin now, they're looking at it from a different lens. They're like, you know, like shit, if this doubles the S&P, like I'm in. You know right. What I mean? And like that's where I think we're kind of going is like, and that's why I don't think like the bull market has started yet, because you look at the correlation between the S&P. Like I know we had like the whole decoupling talk, and I don't think we're, you know, actually there yet. But like, look at that correlation of you know, S&P is down 5% and Bitcoin's up 15%, right? Or I think it's 10% versus, you know, down 5%. Like that stuff is what's important. Like those are the numbers that matter, because like that's the competition, right?
Yeah, 'cause now when they're looking at, okay, this kind of thing is happening in markets, even if the tariff wars slow down and things get better and they start to gain on their, you know, their S&P portfolio, just knowing the fact that before people would have thought, even if there's a 1% chance that Bitcoin will go to zero, it's not worth the risk. But if you understand that, okay, I now think this is not going anywhere, it's worth putting a small portion of my humongous amount of capital in it. That is something that they would do to beat their, because they're looking at it, you're right, not to change their life. They're not looking, they're just thinking, oh, if I get double the S&P, that's cool.
Yeah. How can I make 10 million into 20 million over the next 10 years?
Right.
You know what I mean? Like that's the mm-hmm. view. Which is what? That's 100% increase. That's not, you know what I mean? Like it's not the 100% increase is just doubling in size. What we're talking about when plebs are looking at Bitcoin is not 100% increase. You're looking at a 10,000% increase, right?
Yeah.
You know, and that's kind of like the numbers that we're looking at. So it's you have to kind of frame that with the capital, you know, that's going to be like investing in this. And look, that's why I think I tweeted today, like, get out of crypto if you're still in crypto. If you're in anything other than Bitcoin, like, this money is smart fucking money. They're not your tip, like, they're not your shitcoin casino gamblers that are coming in and moving markets anymore. Right. And so, like, when you look at it from that perspective, it's like there has to be fundamental use cases for this stuff. There has to be something that can't be ripped off.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, like the people talk about XRP and like doing deals with banks and all this stuff. Like what's more likely to happen? That a bank gives control over the currency to another public organization. That's situation one. Hey, yeah, we'll do a contract with XRP and, you know, we'll use your token for finality and settlements and all that stuff. Or option two is they take the technology, they rip it off and they make their own little shitcoin that they handle transactions with internally. Right? They're just going to rip off the technology. There's no use case for any of this stuff. And I'm sick of like pretending that there is.
Yeah. Because you could do the same thing on Lightning if you want to trade or send Bitcoin faster on even on the Aqua L2, you know, that layer two Bitcoin that they have, you can send large transactions, you know, through Lightning. So yeah, there's things that are being built into Bitcoin that you don't need these coins for. Before, people thought they needed to create all these coins because they thought that they're doing something Bitcoin can't do. But Bitcoin is doing this stuff with layers, you know, so it's really just interesting that, you know, it is unnecessary.
They're bringing they're increasing dollar hegemony across the world. And like they're allowing people like saving in saving in Bitcoin requires steps, right? Like if you're in the third world, first you have to trade your local currency in for dollars, then you got to use your dollars to buy Bitcoin, right? Tether is allowing that transfer to happen, right? Because they're, where else are these people going to get dollars? They're not going to, like, no, Chase isn't going to put up a bank in the middle of Venezuela when it's going through, you know, a race war. Like, you know what I mean? Or whatever it is. There's no race wars in Venezuela. they're all Venezuelan. But you know what I'm saying? Like, okay, that's, yeah, like when there's gang stuff going on, they're not going to put up a bank there. So what do? You use an app and now you have people that are on border to Tether and can get access to US dollars. What does that do for that, you know, that that family, right? Now they're able to save in dollars versus the Venezuelan currency. Now you actually can build a stack because your currency is not being devalued at 50% overnight and your wealth stolen. And now you can actually, you know, start to set yourself up for the future. So I've said it a lot of times. Look, I think we need to be careful about the stablecoin regulation, right? That it's not a CBDC in disguise. So again, I think Paolo and the Tether team are against those frameworks. So we'll have to stay vigilant there and make sure that remains the case. But I think they're a net good for the world, like allowing people to get their hands on dollars when they live in places that currencies can be devalued by 50% overnight. Like, that's a good thing. People should be happy about that.
Yeah.
I'd rather Tether be in control of that than it be a central bank digital currency, right? Yeah. I don't trust the Fed. I don't trust Fedcoin to, you know, to do that. So
Tether, as far as I know, it's a decentralized coin in that way. So where XRP or any kind of Fed coin, it would be what, 40% of the supply controlled by a few people. So
yeah, I don't know if Tether is decentralized. I would have to check that. But even if they are centralized, there's a difference between a centralized digital currency and a central bank digital currency, right? One's a private company. The other one is used for surveillance and can be shut off, you know? So like, that's where I think that line is. It is a very fine line that, you know, like Tether's walking. If they start giving data to governments and allow governments to shut things off, like that's where that becomes a problem. But I don't mind it even, look, decentralized, centralized. I do think it is centralized, but I don't mind it because they're going to be, again, the difference, and somebody who's listening to this is inevitably going to tweet at me and say, what's the difference? Like, what are you talking about, you idiot? What's the difference between a central bank digital currency and a centralized digital currency? Look, the difference is that a central bank is run by the governments, and governments are what? They're going to be loyal to nobody. They're going to do whatever they want. A centralized company like Tether is going to be loyal to the customer first. That's the difference between a central bank digital currency and a centralized digital currency like Tether, mm-hmm. is that Tether is going to answer to consumers and governments answer to nobody. Mm-hmm. So that intention and that aligned incentive matters so much.
Yeah, that's so true. And I think that no matter what, it's heading toward a good outcome. That's why all this stuff is just temporary sort of chaos. I think somebody shared one of the threads, or maybe it's a GIF, where when you live in the fiat world, it's all chaos. And then when you're in the Bitcoin world, it's like the slow, steady pulse. How do you like doing your podcast?
I love it. I love it. We finally got the marketing up and running this week. So,
really?
You know, it's been really, really cool. And look, I just love talking about the stuff. I love getting others' opinions. And I think the coolest part about it is, you have all of these people with all these unique different perspectives, and you're just like constantly learning stuff every day. So it's like, I'm doing the podcast, but I also feel like I'm like being taught, mm-hmm. right? You know, amongst that process. And I think it's just been great. Like, you know, it's you meet people, you get to hear their story, and like, I feel like I'll be talking to these people for my entire life, just about this sort of thing. So it's amazing. And I think I have 10 episodes released now. So a few more guests coming up, and trying to do, you know, again, just trying to do something a little bit easier to digest, but also like highlighting the reason that number goes up. You know, it's like, it's not just that this was divinely chosen by God and that's why Bitcoiners have the, you know, the only project that's working out right now. It's because of all of these other underlying aspects that are making people flock to it, you know, from all over the world.
It makes you feel like that, what do they call it? The Goldilocks zone, where that's why the earth is here, because we're the perfect distance from the sun. We like, you know, everything is like just right for us to exist. That's how Bitcoin is. It's like it just worked because all these different things came together.
Yeah.
That allowed it to work. It wasn't just, you know, the math, it wasn't certain things, but that's why, yeah, you're having people being drawn to it because it's something that's just working. So I'm glad you're enjoying it. I mean, you have your marketing up and everything now. So where's that at?
Yeah, so we got it running this week. I have a team of people that are in the music business, and you know, essentially what they're doing is they find ways to market the podcast and make it profitable. And look, they're a lot smarter than I am, but they do it for musicians, right? When you're a musician, you typically, if you're serious about it, you get some sort of marketing team that's pumping out your music and getting it out to the masses. And that's the goal, right? That's always been the goal with the podcast, is just to give people a unique perspective and kind of talk them through everything that we're going through currently. You look back at it and you're like, oh wow, you know, it dropped to 17K and then it went all the way to 100K. Like, it's so easy to just look at those as numbers on a chart, but like all of those days were individual days of uncertainty and of doubt and, you know, people getting shaken out. So I think that like the mission of the podcast is just like, let's try to help people through these times of uncertainty. And look, like when it's good, we'll party, right? You know, it's easy to talk when things are good, but you know, it's in my opinion been really fun to not have the price action while launching it, because it's given us other things to talk about and like build the foundation of why people are, you know, why people are here. You know, so it's amazing. It's so much fun. And I'm going to continue putting out one or two a week.
Yes. You have to keep going. 'Cause you're right. The more that we're doing it, you know, we're doing it because we enjoy talking to more people about it, because we see how it's changing the world. But it's nice to get more voices out there so that anybody can reach a different person, and so that somebody might come across your episodes or my episodes, and anybody else that's thinking about trying this, it's really nice to have our voices just more out there for people so they could hear, again, not during the price action is kind of cool, because you could hear just actual people's stories and what their life is like. And it's not just like it doesn't feel like some crypto bro party where everybody's like pumping the price, yelling about how great everything is. 'Cause it's like, then it starts to feel like we're not here for this transformation, this reason that we're doing this, because it is different. You know, we're actually believing in it when the prices aren't jumping like crazy. And, you know, we're not just trying to do it for engagement or to show off or nothing like that. So,
you can kind of see in the Bitcoin community versus the crypto community is like, when price goes down, people are just gobbling it up, right? And it's like in the crypto community, you have not all, but a lot of like leverage degenerates, right? Who are like freaking out when the price dips because we were told this is going to be a bull market, but like they don't understand the fundamentals. And if they understood the fundamentals, they would be buying Bitcoin and not this other shit to begin with. So it's, you know, you can kind of see that ethos in the community. And, you know, it was funny. I saw a tweet by a real estate investor. It was probably about a month or two ago now. And he was like, can somebody explain why Bitcoiners go nuts every time the price drops? He's like, I've never seen any asset like this. And like, that was his start down the rabbit hole, right? Because he owns real estate. So he wants the price to pump. And, you know, whenever his asset prices are going down, he's like, oh shit. Meanwhile, he sees this other community and it's like, we have a party when the price goes down. It's like, right. What the hell is going on? right? And it speaks to the ethos of the Bitcoin community, right? And it goes back to that like Bitcoin crypto discussion that we had earlier, which is like the ethos of this community is that you don't sell because Bitcoin is the money, right? Unless you're 100% allocated like me, then you sell to pay bills every month. I'm using it both ways. But like when you're storing and you're putting like 10 or 20% in this thing, it's the last thing you touch because it is the actual money, right? Mm-hmm. And in all these crypto projects, I'm being nice, I'm not calling them shit coins, but in all of these crypto projects, what is it? It's like you want the price to pump so you can get rid of it. Like yeah. Fundamentally, if you want to understand, if you're listening to this podcast and you're like, all right, why Bitcoin versus anything else? Like this is the point to get.
Yes.
When the price goes up in Ethereum, people are happy so they can sell it and get into Bitcoin. When Bitcoin it's true. And when Bitcoin goes up, people are still just DCAing into it, right? They're trying not to sell it. They're only selling it for what's necessary. But it's like that's the fundamental difference between what we're looking at right now. And that's why Bitcoin doesn't go to zero. It's like, because who's going to sell it?
Right.
It's like, it's just not.
You're
so
right.
Not in the ethos.
Yeah. Even the traders that are thinking, I'm going to sell this coin if I get out at the right time to be rich or whatever, they do want to keep to sell for fiat, and they do want to have dollars in the bank. But also a lot of those people that understand crypto, they feel like they're trading to try to get more Bitcoin. So it's like, they're not like,
yeah,
you know what I mean? They're not just, they actually do want the better asset. They understand what crypto is to be trading crypto in the first place. But I think that they do it to think like in that mindset where you're right. The rest of us, we're not trading it. We're just, if it drops, we get to have more for a cheaper price. It's on sale. And it's an entirely different group of people. So it's like, that's a really great point.
That's like my story in a nutshell. Like I got into Bitcoin first and I was like, oh, I'm late. And I was trading, meme coins to try to make more Bitcoin. And luckily I lost my first $1,000 because I'm not good at trading. And that was it, you know? Yeah. And so like, that's, I think the main, I think a lot of these guys that are still here that have been around for multiple rug pulls, like mm-hmm. they're still chasing that high of like, well, if this thing goes 50x and I have a grand in it and I make 50,000, I can buy a half.
Well, it also reminds me that some of these people that have really big channels that are discussing trading and they have like a lot of viewers on YouTube, it makes you wonder that because if they're talking about some little coin and saying, oh, it's about to break out, you better get in on this coin, they're the ones kind of pumping the price to get all their viewers to go buy some. And then they dump on your ass. So it's kind of like, are they, because if it's such a small market cap on a coin they're talking about that you're like, oh, I didn't think to look at that one. It's so small. I'm going to be rich because it's got a little market cap.
That's why a lot of these guys do it. I mean, you saw it with Fred Krueger did it, right? He like claims he was a Bitcoin maxi and, did a rug pull. It was weird. It was funny because it was right when I got back on Twitter. It was like the night he did it.
Really?
And I was like, looking at it, I'm like, this guy like claims he was a maxi and then out of nowhere rug pulls for 250 grand, right?
Yeah.
Makes like 250K on it. And then what? I'm sure he bought Bitcoin with it.
Right. That's what it is. Yeah.
And so it's a very interesting market to be a part of. And that's why these people do it, right? Like that's why you see the influencers launching their own coins. You saw the Hawktua coin, right? Like that girl made millions of dollars and wasn't prosecuted for it.
Right.
I'm not saying she should be prosecuted for it. I think that's a whole different discussion.
I know, but it's like, it's
a moral thing at that point.
Yeah.
I just think that like, if you're dumb enough to buy it, then, you deserve it.
Right. But that's what it is. It's like, they think she's thought I'm so popular right now because I made a meme or whatever you call that. But she got insanely famous. So it's like, let's make a coin. It'll get insanely popular because I'm trending right now and all this stuff. And then you can make a crap ton of money really fast. So it's like, yeah, it's your fault for falling for it and thinking this is going to be something. So yeah, it sucks. People do lose money, but that's how you learn. And It's definitely a good lesson to learn. You know, don't trust these traders on YouTube with a lot of followers because they're probably just pumped up the price enough to get you to think it's going to moon or something. So
I'm grateful that I didn't get lucky with the meme coins and like think that I was some sort of genius. Like a lot of these people have just been lucky because the altcoin market has, you know, like alt season was a thing. But it's just like if you, a lot of those guys did get lucky and now they're delusional and they think it's going to be a thing because they got lucky, right? It created this false sense of like, I'm a god at trading and like, you know,
it's like a gambler going to Vegas and you're like, oh, I won this time. I'm going to win every time I go to Vegas. I'm so good at gambling, yeah. But you don't win every other time you lose, you know? So
yeah, exactly. It's this, but because there's charts in this analysis and number go up, like people actually thought that it had more merit than a casino. And you're going to continue to see that. I mean, new coins are being made every day. There's going to be some that claim to be, you know, the next Bitcoin or this or that. And it's just, it's not going to happen. You know, I would say if, you know, I placed $100 on Bryson DeChambeau to win the Masters yesterday, I would say you're better off, picking the winner of a golf tournament than picking the next Bitcoin. Or picking the next meme coin that competes with Bitcoin or tries to.
Seriously.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for joining me. I have had a great talk with you. This has been great to discuss all these things.
Happy to be back.
Thank you for joining me on your show and good luck with your show. I am so happy for you that you have the marketing going. You have a team behind you. You have friends that are helping push your content to reach more people. So that's what's important. And again, it's not because it helps. We don't want, like, the more people it reaches, the price will eventually go up. And you know that we celebrate when the price does drop, because we get more of it. So yes, but we still, because we care about everybody and we want people to also know that there's an exit, we do want to let people know, and we want to spread the word and get our content out there. So everyone follow Hold My Beer Show, right?
Yeah, Hold My Beer Show.
And I'm going to link it
on YouTube. Yeah.
Yes. I'm going to link it. I'm going to link your page and whatever else you want me to link. So whatever else you want to tell everybody.
Yeah, no, thank you. It's I'm glad we got together again. I had so much fun, you know, when we had you on a little while back. So it's good to be on here.
Thank you.
And kind of share a little bit, especially with all the craziness going on. You know, I guess the last thing that I would say, you know, to everybody is look, like, number go up is still important because that's how people's lives change, right? But to your point, what's more important is that number's going up because more plebs are buying the supply, not necessarily because BlackRock is or because the US government is. And the more people that, you know, we can speak to and get on these, you know, get on the train, so to speak, it's good for humanity, right? And so that's kind of the mission between both of our podcasts is just to kind of spread the good word, you know, as we see it and with what's going on. But yeah, you guys can follow the show on YouTube at Hodl My Beer Show. And, you know, I'm giving away a BitAx at 250 subscribers. So we're about quarter away there. And you guys can find me on Twitter, you know, at Mr. MR Trey Arch. So pumped to come on here. And thanks so much for having me, Stacey.
Thank you so much. Thanks for joining me. Have a great rest of the day.
Thanks. You too.
Take care. Bye-bye.